Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello, Critic listeners, and welcome to this week's podcast. As we are in the midst of what feels like a never-ending lockdown, Graham Stewart speaks to Kapil Komaredi and Toby Young about the origins of this crisis, whether we should be in a lockdown at all, and whether saving vulnerable lives is an economic price worth paying. Kapil Komaredi is the successful author of Malevolent Republic, a short history of the new India, which has earned rave reviews from around the world. And Toby Young is commentator, journalist, author, and founder of Free Speech Union, having recently set up the website lockdownskeptics.org, a place for those who question official approaches and information about the coronavirus crisis.
Toby and Kapil, welcome both to the Critic podcast. I want to start, we will come shortly to the British situation, but I want to start, Kapil, with you, and I want to start where the coronavirus started in China. Is it your view that the response initially of the Chinese government is the reason the world is now in the predicament it finds itself?
Part of the reason, a big part of the reason, is the initial cover-up of the outbreak. And in the piece I wrote for The Critic, I detailed it, and I will go over it now. The first case came in early December, and they were whistleblowers in Wuhan. There were doctors. The first whistleblower was a female doctor who was silenced by the officials in Wuhan. And the second one, whose case we know about in greater detail, was a young doctor, an ophthalmologist, called Li Wenliang. He told his friends on WeChat, 8 of them, that I've seen at my hospital, this is the Wuhan Central Hospital, a number of patients have been quarantined and they're exhibiting symptoms akin to the SARS epidemic of 2003. And when SARS flared up in 2003, the Chinese government suppressed information and it arrested the man who was the whistleblower, indoctrinated him for 45 days, a 72-year-old doctor. And he said, this time we need to be more careful. And what the government did, what the authorities did is they invited him and they reprimanded him and they made him to sign a retraction and a confession saying that he was ashamed of himself for spreading lies. And as they were doing this, the cases continued to mount up. And by the 2nd of January, the scientists in Wuhan had already mapped the genome of the virus. But this information wasn't shared with the world until the 9th of January. And it is only, and the local officials of the Communist Party proceeded with an annual lunar function. 40,000 families were hosted at a lavish banquet, a potluck banquet. And this is the busiest period in China. This is their most important festival. And there was a lot of movement back and forth. And the first time President Xi actually got involved in any serious manner was the 20th of January. And within 10 days, the death toll had climbed to 200 within China alone. But China continued to deny that this disease was transmitted from human to human. Now, there's a very sophisticated study done by the Southampton University that says had China acted early, there would have been 95% fewer casualties. That is extraordinary to think. And the reason China only came clean is because there were cases abroad. If this had been contained at home, China would never have come clean. Because we know for a fact that the Chinese authorities ordered the local labs to destroy samples and not to do any further testing. And the conduct of the World Health Organization is very interesting to note because as late as the 14th of January, the World Health Organization was telling the world that this disease doesn't transmit from humans to humans, even though on the 31st of December, Taiwan, which has denied membership of the WHO, informed the World Health Organization that there was concrete evidence that this disease moved from human to human. So this was part of a pattern of behavior by the Communist Party of China. And the outbreak, the flare-up, the rapidity with which it spread, the inability of the world governments to actually do anything about it or do anything while it was too late to do anything is, I think, the direct result of the early failure of the Chinese government to be transparent and actually to move and suppress information. It is inseparable from the nature of the Chinese government.
And do we have a feeling that the errors made by the World Health Organization and by other governments in taking China at its word but not taking Taiwan at its word, these were essentially political misjudgments, or they were simple errors made in good faith?
Well, the World Health Organization was given teeth in the previous decade. It is the only organization in the world with the authority to declare a global health emergency. And this power was given to it precisely to avoid what had happened in 2003 when the information about SARS didn't really come out and there were 774 fatalities and the disease had spread to 29 countries. It is to avert that kind of a situation that the World Health Organization was given these powers. But it didn't utilize them. In February, at the end of February, when this disease has spread to dozens of countries, 8,000 people were infected by it. Dr. Tedros, who's not a physician, who's the head of World Health Organization, was praising China and saying the world owes a great debt to China because it bought the world time. This was patently false. What China was doing, and his officials knew, that China's early suppression of details had actually made this much worse. So the role played by the World Health Organization is very... It's something that is shocking, because every step taken to avert a calamity of the kind we're witnessing today, all the powers given to it, none of them were used. In fact, the World Health Organization, under the leadership of Tedros, went to great lengths to give shield to China, to cover up China's missteps in the early months. And this is something that needs a very close look.
Can I ask a question, Kapil? It's very interesting... your account of the Chinese authorities' efforts to suppress the initial whistleblower or the doctor who raised the alarm. And there's certainly a parable about the importance of free speech there, because had the Chinese authorities not tried to silence that doctor, then it's perfectly possible that the virus could have been contained and many hundreds of thousands of deaths, possibly millions of deaths, could have been prevented. But do you think one of the reasons the Chinese authorities reacted in the way they did, at least initially, is because they're worried that the reason for the outbreak was not back to human transmission at the human seafood market, but an accident at the Wuhan Institute of Virology? I don't know if you've looked into that particular theory, but I've looked at a couple of articles and fairly respectable YouTubers who've explored that theory. And initially, I thought it was clearly a paranoid conspiracy theory, but actually, the more I've looked into it, the more credible that theory appears to be.
The answer to that question is there's a very one of India's most foremost strategists, Brahma Chelani, often talked of as the next national security advisor, has written extensively about this, and he tweeted last month a screenshot of the Global Times, which is the Chinese newspaper, which touted the fact that Wuhan has the largest largest collection of viruses, and the Global Times deleted that tweet, and a group of independent Chinese journalists put up a similar article saying that this could be an outbreak originating in a lab, but that article was also deleted. So I do not have, there is no conclusive proof that this was an outbreak at the lab. And the rush to suppress information is understandable. It doesn't necessarily need to have broken out at a lab for the government to suppress it. Because when you become the epicenter of an outbreak, you suffer in other ways. You're unable to export your food. People don't want to travel to your country. Your tourism suffers. Various countries have experienced the fallout from being epicenters of virus outbreaks. So that could be the reason why China decided to suppress it. But primarily, it is the nature of the Chinese government. You mentioned free speech, and that, I think, is the most important thing here. It, you know, the best way to contain pandemics is to have free flow of information. You know, if this... the director of Chatham House, or the chairperson of chairman of Chatham House, went on television in America and said, we should be grateful that this didn't happen in India. Actually, had this happened in India, I think we would have been able to contain this faster because Indian newspapers would have published it, the world would have been able to act on it, and the reason it happened the way it did is because there is no free flow of information in China. And to this date, the people in Wuhan do not know the full number of casualties. The morgues there have filled up. I've read one article in Radio Free Asia, which spoke to the locals in Wuhan. They say there were about 42,000 deaths. And it is very important for newspapers in places where there is free speech and there is democracy and there is freedom not to keep repeating that America has a bigger number of... the death toll in America is bigger than China's, because we do not know the full figure in China. We do not know what is happening in China. The people of Wuhan, they're very angry, but, you know, nobody is wanting to talk to them. Nobody is looking at their tragedy. There are thousands and thousands of deaths there because there have been thousands of funerals in a very short space of time. And it is, you've said something very important, free speech. And it is the absence of free speech that led China, the reflexive reaction of the Chinese authorities is to contain, to suppress, stamp on anything that appears to go against the party line. And they had a very important political congress happening in the month of January, and they couldn't brook anything that was going to wrinkle that.
Toby, do you feel that there were steps that could have been taken in the UK earlier, which would have prevented now the extreme lockdown that this country is enduring?
Certainly, the initial reaction of the British authorities was to play down just how infectious and how dangerous COVID-19 is. And it's possible, I think, that had the UK authorities introduced some more moderate social distancing measures and more effective social distancing measures at an earlier stage, then they wouldn't have needed to ramp up those measures so quickly. So, for instance, the wearing of masks... the WHO and the Surgeon General of the United States, amongst others, are complicit in playing down the effectiveness of masks at the beginning of the outbreak, in part because they were concerned that there wouldn't be enough PPE for medical staff if the public began to buy up masks in bulk. But it's now clear that masks are actually, the correct masks worn correctly, are a more effective way of preventing the spread of the virus even than hand washing. So it could be that the UK authorities could have recommended the wearing of masks and ramped up the production of masks, imported effective masks, in a way which could have led to a more measured containment than the measures they did introduce about 3 weeks ago.
And it's a question to both of you. The sort of approaches that South Korea and Singapore have taken... Singapore now, incidentally, has gone on to a pretty major lockdown. But initially, it was a track and tracing policy using mobile phone data. And also, you know, a large spread of clinics across what's admittedly a very small country. Those kind of techniques, I mean, could they have been rolled out in larger countries, or do they only really work in geographically tight spaces?
Well, can I just come back? I will leave it to Toby to answer that question, but can I just respond to your question about your point about masks? It's very important to note that the World Health Organization to this day says that masks are not do not play a role in stopping the spread of this virus, and they're essential only for frontline healthcare workers. So it's the advice that is being given by the World Health Organization continues to imperil the lives of people, because as Toby has just mentioned, there are studies that say that masks are even more effective in stopping the spread of COVID than hand washing. And yet, the official advice of the World Health Organization is that masks are only necessary for frontline workers. As a professor at Georgetown University said, that we've been conned, we've been misled by the World Health Organization right from the beginning. And this is another aspect of that story of being misled. And as to the containment based on the sizes of countries, I'll leave that to Toby to answer.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, but there doesn't appear to be a correlation between the severity of the social distancing measures that countries have imposed and the number of excess deaths, that is to say, the number of deaths that have occurred in excess to the monthly average for this time of year across the world. So I'm looking at the European Monitoring of Excess Mortality for Public Health Action, which is a website which monitors excess deaths. That is to say, it monitors the death rate at the moment in different countries across the world on a week-to-week basis, with the average death rate in those countries for this week in a normal year. And it shows that the excess death rate in the UK, excess deaths in the UK, is presently very high. This is for week 14 of 2020. It's very high in Italy and in Spain and in France. But it's normal in Sweden. It's normal in Japan. It's normal in Singapore. It's normal in Denmark. So in various countries which have imposed much more moderate lockdowns, particularly Sweden, there doesn't seem to be any evidence of excess deaths. That is to say, deaths aren't any higher for the first week of April, the second week of April in those countries, than they would be in a normal year. So even though the British authorities believe that the suppression measures that have been introduced have flattened the peak of infection, there doesn't seem to be much evidence that less severe measures would have created a greater number of excess deaths, not based on this particular analysis. But it is, you know, we have incomplete information and it's early days.
There was a model in India which is now undergoing the largest lockdown in human history, 1.3 billion people. There was an early model that said that if you do not impose social distancing measures and introduce a lockdown, up to 500 million people could be infected, and the mortality rate would be 1 to 5% of the infected. And that prompted the Prime Minister to announce a lockdown on 4 hours' notice. So the effectiveness of social distancing, we will only learn of it in the months to come. But there is, scientists have rung the alarm, and there is very prompt reaction in places such as India and in Britain. Britain came late to it. But there are also countries that are defying it, as Toby mentioned. The full picture will only emerge after we come out of this, I think.
What is a government to do, though, in fairness? If you're either the Modi government in India or the Johnson government in the UK, when you are presented with statistical analysis which involves the scale of potential fatality, do you really have any other option but to pursue a lockdown?
One of my criticisms, I think, of the way in which the UK government has acted is that they are only listening to, seemingly, one team of modellers, which is the Imperial College team led by Professor Neil Ferguson. And they're not listening to other sources of advice who come up with very different models. So there's the unit at Oxford University, which is a long-standing rival of Professor Ferguson's unit at Imperial College. And there's a lot of history there between Professor Gupta, the leader of the team at Oxford, and Professor Ferguson. But the Oxford model showed a much higher number of British people infected than the Imperial model, and of course that's a critical thing to understand. If it's the case that, say, 50% of the UK population has already had the virus, then obviously there's much less need to impose extreme social distancing, because the number of people you're trying to protect from getting it is far fewer. So the UK authorities seem to be constantly increasing their estimate of the percentage of the UK population which has been infected. So initially it was very small. In the Imperial College model, the assumption was, something like 1 or 2%. At yesterday's, we're speaking today on Good Friday, but at yesterday's press conference, Chris Whitty was asked how many people he thought had been infected, and he said most of the early Porton Down preliminary findings, because Porton Down is now doing some research trying to determine what percentage of the population in the UK has been infected, was in single figures, so less than 10%. But he said in some cases it was higher than single figures, and he also let slip, seemingly was a slip, that he thought globally it looked as though 30%. Of the world's population had been infected. Now, we won't know for sure until we've done some, representative testing and we've got reliable tests. But my suspicion is that it's going to be closer to the Oxford model than Imperial College's model. And it seems it would be sensible if the government weren't just advised by one team of modellers, but took soundings from a variety of teams. I mean, it's been quite difficult to challenge Professor Ferguson's model. He is understandably quite defensive about it, and there is this tendency on his part and on the part of other people in authority to say that any challenging of the Imperial College model is dangerous. Because it may mean the public won't observe the social distancing measures that have been put in place, but I think that's not a very grown up attitude. I think we need to have a properly informed scientific discussion between different groups of experts who disagree about things like the percentage of the UK population that's been infected, and that the government's decision making should be informed by that debate and not just the dogmatic assertions of one particular group of modellers.
Of course, one of the problems is that the modelling at the moment, none of it is based on accurate statistics, because we simply don't have the level of testing. the various antibody tests that have been trialled in the UK so far haven't worked sufficiently well to be rolled out. So we could have a battle of the statisticians and a battle of the modellers for the next 2 or 3 months without anything really being concluded or anything for a government to act upon with any certainty. And meanwhile, you know, a lockdown for another 2 or 3 months, not only economically catastrophic, but it begins to create all sorts of health problems, including mental health problems, which could be as bad or worse as anything coronavirus is doing to the population.
But as the numbers rise, may I just add that as the number of dead rise, it's important to remember that there is a fallacy of selection here, because the denominator here is not confirmed cases, you know, but the actual total number of infections. If you take that into account, the actual number of death is very, very small. And in a country such as India, which is home to 1.3 billion people, the lockdown has actually led to incredible suffering. There's tremendous human misery. That there are more than 80 people who've died of starvation, of things like not being able to go back home, of tiredness, of exhaustion, of dehydration, as a result of a lockdown that was announced on 4 hours' notice. So it's very important to remember the people who are suffering as a result of this lockdown. And most of us will be all right, but the poorest will be hurt the worst as a result.
Yeah, the other bit of data, the other data point that we desperately need to get a better understanding of. So the first one is the percentage of the British population that's been infected. The second is the infection fatality rate. We know the case fatality rate. To get the case fatality rate, you just divide the number of people who've tested positive by the number of people that have died with coronavirus, although there is some debate about whether there's a distinction between dying with coronavirus and dying of coronavirus. And it may be that the case fatality rate has been exaggerated because people who've died with coronavirus haven't died of coronavirus. Dr. John Lee wrote a good piece about that for The Spectator. But the critical data point we need to understand is not the case fatality rate, but the infection fatality rate. That is, what percentage of people who are infected with the virus die? And that is obviously going to be much lower than the case fatality rate, because the number of people who tested positive doesn't reflect the number of people in the population who've actually been infected, because, you know, we haven't done that testing yet. We don't know. But in those countries where they've done much more extensive testing than the UK and have built up a picture of the a more accurate idea of what the infection fatality rate is, it's much lower than was assumed in the Imperial College model. So in Iceland, for instance, which has done more per capita testing than anywhere else, the case fatality rate is about 0.3%, whereas the Imperial College model assumed that the case fatality rate would be 0.9% in the UK. But it looks like the infection fatality rate in Iceland is going to be lower than the case fatality rate, and the infection fatality rate globally is likely to be lower than that too. I predict it will end up being around 0.2%, which is about twice the infection fatality rate of seasonal flu. But it's important that we should understand not just the percentage of the British population that's been infected, but what the infection fatality rate is, in order to get accurately predict what the demand for critical hospital care might be if we are to relax some of the more extreme social distancing measures.
I don't have much expertise on the subject. I tend to think that to the maximum extent possible, the avoidance of death should be the pressing priority of all governments, and I think that is what they're being led by, and the fear of bodies piling up is prompting governments to take very severe measures against people crowding, especially in India. The word that comes to mind when you think of India is multitudes. India is crowds, and the streets of India are completely deserted. People are indoors. There is, as I've mentioned already, tremendous, unspeakable indescribable suffering among the poorest people of India, who have been completely left out of any economic analysis. And there needs to be very urgent action to feed them, to give them care. But it is what this has really done, I think, in a country such as India, is exposed the failures of successive governments to create capacities to deal with, to provide basic healthcare. And I think once this is behind us, again, I repeat, I don't have expertise and I don't want to talk about things I don't have expertise about. But once this is behind us, I think this should prompt us to really consider our priorities, and especially in India, and attend to the most... We talk about becoming the next superpower in India. That has been one of the obsessions of the past decade. And I think our priority should be able to feed people and to be able to supply them healthcare, to supply them housing, to create sanitary conditions in the cities and the villages of India. And this pandemic has really exposed everything, all the failures of India are on vivid display for the world to see. And this is quite embarrassing, and this is very saddening for me as an Indian to witness.
Toby, you've argued in The Critic that the billions that are now being spent on the British government's current policy, you know, a fraction of that could have been spent on the NHS earlier with better results. Is that a fair summary of your position?
Well, that was one argument I made in my article in The Critic. I argued that essentially the cure was looking like it's worse than the disease, and made a number of arguments. The most controversial was trying to assess the value of the additional years of life that are likely to be saved by the extreme social distancing measures that have been introduced, and to try and come up with a kind of total figure in the billions which would be the value of those years of life saved, and compare them with the economic cost of the lockdown. And Sam Bowman and I got into a dispute. I came up with one figure, he disputed that. I then replied to his critique, and people can go to The Critic's website and read those exchanges. That was one argument. Another argument is that if we're going to spend the kind of money that the lockdown is going to cost us because we are prioritizing saving lives, well, we could actually spend a fraction of that money on increasing the NHS's budget and probably save more years of life than we're saving by entering into the lockdown. That's the argument you mentioned just now. There's a third argument, and probably the best argument, I think, is that economic downturns do cause loss of life. That's controversial, but there is some evidence that during the global economic recession of 2007-09, suicide rates increased quite significantly in the United States and in Europe. And it's likely that if there's an economic contraction in the UK as a consequence of the lockdown, which there will be, that could cause a rise in suicide. There'll also be a rise in violent crime, poverty, homelessness, a general decline in public health, as well as mental health. And you can, so I think you can make an argument. In fact, a professor of risk management at Bristol University has made this argument. He's argued that if the impact of the lockdown is a shrinking of GDP per head of at least 6.4% over the next 2 years, that will lead to a greater loss of life than the lives we are hoping to save as a consequence of the lockdown. And that's just measuring the impact of the lockdown in terms of loss of life. And it looks as though it will be greater than 6.4%. The latest OECD estimate is that the UK economy will shrink by 25% over the next 2 years if the lockdown is prolonged. And I think the impact, the economic impact of the lockdown, we're only just beginning to grasp, and it's much more severe than we initially anticipated. The unemployment rate in the US is much higher, I think, than people had anticipated. The number of people claiming universal credit now in the UK is higher than anticipated. The cost of the bailout that Rishi Sunak has announced is going to be higher than anticipated. It looks as though just the impact of the lockdown, if it's prolonged, in terms of lives lost, is going to be greater than the number of lives saved as a result of imposing the lockdown, at which point it begins to not make much sense to prolong it any further. And there's a final argument, Graham, which is one argument for prolonging the lockdown is that if we can prolong it for long enough, we will eventually have a vaccine. That was the assumption in the Imperial College paper published on March 16th, which was so pivotal in changing the government's mind and moving from a mitigation to a suppression strategy. The assumption in that paper is that we would have a vaccine. We will have a vaccine within 18 months, and that the lockdown should essentially be kept in place. There may be an opportunity to ease it off, only to then reapply it in a kind of intermittent way. But nonetheless, the assumption in that paper is that there'll be a vaccine in 18 months, and therefore we should prolong the lockdown, to all intents and purposes, for 18 months. Well, that'll be absolutely economically catastrophic. But in addition, I think it's very optimistic to think that there will be a vaccine in 18 months. We still don't have a vaccine for swine flu. Sometimes it takes a very long time to develop vaccines. And the coronavirus may mutate into different strains. So we may develop a vaccine for one form of the current coronavirus of COVID-19, and then discover that we're now facing another different virus. If we conclude that we're not going to come up with a vaccine within the next 18 months, it's going to take longer than that, and we just cannot afford to keep the lockdown in place in perpetuity. We're going to have to abandon it sooner rather than later. We're going to have to abandon it at some point before a vaccine emerges. And so why not abandon it sooner rather than later? Because there's no gain in keeping it in place any longer than we have to. One of the assumptions, again, in the Imperial College model is that as soon as the extreme social distancing measures are relaxed, then infections begin to climb again. And that's the reason you have to keep it in place for 18 months. It's not just a case of keeping it in place while you flatten the peak of infection and then you can start to relax. It has to be kept in place until the vaccine becomes available. But if we're not going to keep it in place until a vaccine becomes available, we're not going to gain anything in terms of lives saved. We're just putting off that loss of life while we keep the lockdown in place. So why not end the lockdown sooner rather than later?
Toby, may I ask you, will you accept that if the lockdown is removed, the death toll will rise? You've packed a lot into that, and I've paid close attention to that. You accept that if we remove the lockdown, if we relax the lockdown, or had the lockdown never happened, the death toll would be significantly higher?
It depends, I think, how much you're packing into that word significantly. I think the death toll would probably rise if we began to ease off on some of the lockdown measures. I think we can, I'm not suggesting that we abandon social distancing altogether. I think we could still insist on the quarantining of the elderly and the vulnerable. We could still encourage people who don't have to travel to work from home. We could encourage people who do have to travel to work to wear masks, but we could effectively end the lockdown and begin to restart the economy, and that might result in an uptick in the number of deaths. The critical question is, the $6 million question is, would it result in the NHS becoming overwhelmed? And to calculate that, you need to know what percentage of the population has already been infected and what the infection fatality rate is. I think that there is mounting evidence that the NHS would be able to cope with the likely increase in demand if you began to relax some of the social distancing measures but kept others in place, as I've just described. I think that one of the assumptions that's probably wrong in the Imperial College model is the surge capacity of the NHS. One of the reasons the advice of Professor Ferguson and his team changed in the March 16th paper is that they said that they had overestimated the emergency surge capacity of the NHS, as well as underestimating the likely demand for critical hospital care. Now, I think they overestimated the likely demand for critical hospital care absence suppression. But I also think that they underestimated the emergency surge capacity of the NHS. If you look at the speed with which the Nightingale Hospital, for instance, has been put up, which has the capacity to treat 4,000 patients and probably many more, I think that the NHS, in all likelihood, could cope with the smallish uptick in demand for critical care if some of the more extreme social distancing measures were relaxed.
Right. You said there would be an uptick in the number of dead if social distancing were relaxed, but you dispute the use of the word significant.
Yes. The critical calculation, I think, is would the loss of life resulting from the relaxing of some social distancing measures be greater than the lives you would effectively save by restarting the economy?
Right. If we didn't restart the economy, you are proposing that there will be, you are arguing that there will be a significant loss of life. There will be more
yes.
deaths if we continue to keep the lockdown in place.
Yes.
Or there will be great economic misery.
Yes.
And I'm to an extent sympathetic because I come from a generation that, you know, I began university a few years after 9/11 and the war on terror was taking place at the time. When we entered the job market, the economic depression began, and once we got settled in the jobs, once the economic recession reversed, Donald Trump became president, and just as Donald Trump's term comes to the end, we have a global pandemic. So, you know, two decades of misery, and I sympathize with that. And what Toby's argument is that, you know, there is a generation of people whose lives could be improved by creating a better economy. My feeling about this is, having read Toby's article, is that I don't think the loss of life is a cost worth paying, because the deaths of these people are irreversible. Once people die because of relaxation of social distancing, those deaths will be irreversible. And this is a generation of people, the elderly, who've actually built the world we inhabit right now. You know, they are owed a degree of respect and compassion and affection and dedication. And their debts will be irreversible. And the misery Toby speaks of, if social distancing were relaxed and the economy were restarted, if the economy wasn't restarted, the misery Toby predicts will overtake us. That can, I think, be mitigated. I think we underestimate human ingenuity. And I think there are many economists, I've certainly read pieces by Indian economists who've argued about the ways to kickstart the Indian economy after this comes out. And remember, India is an enormous country. Its challenges are multitudinous. And I think we shouldn't ever gamble. This is my position, of course. I speak only for myself. I wouldn't want to gamble with the lives of people. Every death is unimaginably sad for people, and if it can be prevented, it should be. That is my position. I have elderly parents, and I have elderly people who are very dear to me, and the idea that I could keep my job or have a prosperous life in the coming years at the expense of their lives seems perverse to me. But I'm sympathetic to the argument Toby makes, because I think he's not coming from a place of he's not evil as he's being described. I think he's coming from a place that he wants to help a generation of people, but I think that's not the cost worth paying, because death is irreversible, and I think we can mitigate the pain that people predict will be suffered by a vast amount of human beings if the lockdown isn't lifted.
I'd quibble with your use of the word gamble there, Kapil. I think that...
I say the word gamble, Toby, because all of these are projections, and absolutely nothing is certain except that if you're struck down by COVID and you're elderly and you have pre-existing conditions, there is a greater likelihood of dying than the projections being made by economists that say that if the lockdown continues, there will be catastrophe, unmitigatable catastrophe. I don't feel that catastrophe is unmitigable.
Well, I think the when I said I quibble with your use of the word gamble, I was just wanting to make the point that you're gambling either way. Yes, you'd be gambling with the lives of elderly and vulnerable people if you relax some of the social distancing measures, but you're gambling with other people's lives if you keep those social distancing measures in place. And if the government's objective is to minimise loss of life, either course is a gamble, and it's not clear that the precautionary principle dictates one course, the present course, rather than another. I think you do raise a really good point, which is that I think it's a choice between more tangible, visible deaths on the one hand. You know, we can imagine, we can picture the people who would suffer and possibly die if we were to relax the social distancing measures. It's much harder to picture the impact, catastrophic impact of a prolonged economic depression. It's sort of a way, you're sort of comparing visible deaths with invisible deaths, imaginable, tangible deaths with deaths which are harder to imagine. They're more statistical deaths, like the likely impact on a generation, as you say. But that doesn't mean they're less real. And it may be that the way in which we think about these questions morally is slightly distorted by whether we have elderly parents, whether we know elderly people who we think, or other people who are at risk, when a more clear-headed moral calculation might lead us to just kind of in a more forensic way try and measure the years of life likely to be lost if we relax the social distancing measures compared to the years of life likely to be lost if we keep them in place. I think finally, you make a good point about the fact that the elderly and the vulnerable, those with underlying health conditions, are those most at risk if we were to relax the social distancing measures. And even though, on the one hand, if you're being a kind of cold-hearted health economist, you value those lives less highly than the lives of young, healthy people or younger healthy people, because they have less years to live and the years they have left aren't going to be as good as the years that people without underlying health conditions have. But I think from a moral point of view, we do feel a greater obligation to protect the elderly and the vulnerable than we do healthy younger people. So that makes the moral calculation, I think, quite difficult to do too.
I sympathise with your concern for what you say as the invisible debt who will not be taken into account. I feel that the invisible deaths can be prevented. The suffering of the people to come can be mitigated. But if the deaths actually occur as a result of relaxation of social distancing or any other measures that are proven to actually reduce mortality, those deaths are irreversible. I think... and this is the disagreement you and I have is largely philosophical. To me, I think the inability of healthy people like you and me, younger people, to care for the elderly, to do everything possible to prevent their death, bespeaks a decline, a great civilizational decline. I think, what is the point of coming to this point in civilization, having this advancement, if we can't even protect the lives, knowing doing things that we know will protect their lives. If we don't do that, I think there is a great decline, and that's a cause for deep sorrow. You speak about the deaths that will not be visible, and I applaud your concern for those people. I just feel that our energies should be thrown into finding ways to mitigate that suffering rather than to believe that that suffering will take place. I think we shouldn't underestimate our own ingenuity, and we should do everything possible to mitigate the suffering to come if we know that we can actually prevent the deaths that will happen if we relax the social distancing measure or any of the draconian lockdowns that we're witnessing.
I certainly think it's a very difficult choice for politicians to make, because if they were to say, look, a far larger number of invisible deaths will occur than visible deaths if we prolong the lockdown, and therefore we're going to ease back on some of these social distancing measures, and then we see an uptick in visible deaths, it's going to be hard for politicians to say, oh yes, what we did cause this increase in deaths, but we've prevented all these other people from dying. It'll be hard to persuade the electorate that that was the right decision, because they will inevitably value and attach more importance to those people that have died as a result of relaxing the social distancing measures than the lives, the more notional lives that you've saved as a result of easing off on some of those social distancing measures. But just to make one point, Capel, this wouldn't be a kind of new and kind of brutalist direction for Western civilization to take. Western governments make these calculations when deciding how to allocate resources in their public health systems all the time. You know, you place a value on the years of life that you think are going to be saved by introducing a new medical therapy, introducing a new medical device. So governments have been making these cold-hearted, brutal calculations which involve valuing people's lives. And the way they generally do that is to estimate how many years of good life they've got left. So it wouldn't be, you know, even Labour governments make these kind of decisions based on health economics. So it wouldn't be a new direction. Unfortunately, we've been making these kind of calculations for decades.
Well, I'm afraid I've got to make a calculation of how long we've got left for this podcast, and our time is up, gentlemen. I've been talking to Capel Comaretti and to Toby Young. Thank you very both for your insights in a debate which has got much time to run.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.